Well, welcome everyone to this fabulous session of the Wheeler Centre. It's a delight to be here. I'm Eleanor Hall from ABC Radio's The World Today program. And today's session is basically about foreign correspondence. In the age of fast news, few resources and global technology, are foreign correspondents becoming redundant? Or are they a vital investment in properly bearing witness? Three esteemed former foreign correspondents will reveal experiences from the front, sharing on-the-job tales, stories of the long-term effects of the role, although I can tell you they won't tell you very many of them, and a long look at how it's evolved over the years, from the days before email, before mobile phones, and certainly before Twitter and Facebook. Let me introduce them. Tony Clifton, who's in the middle here, spent 40 years working as a foreign correspondent, covering conflicts around the world for publications like Newsweek and the London Sunday Times. Cameron Forbes has been foreign editor, Europe correspondent and Asia correspondent for The Age and Washington correspondent for The Australian. He's reported on rebellions, civil wars, wars in Northern Ireland, Portugal, Sri Lanka, South Africa, Bougainville, the Philippines, Burma, the Middle East, Afghanistan and Rwanda. And Michael Keats is a journalist with more than 50 years' experience as a foreign correspondent and in editorial management. In his career, he reported from 88 of the 193 member countries of the United Nations for United Press International. And we're going to start with how the technology has changed the way that we report foreign events. It's amazing if you think back that Facebook is only 10 years old. Twitter is, I think, barely seven. And even when I started reporting, which admittedly is a couple of decades ago, mobile phones were starting out. And they weren't the mobile phones that we held in our hands. They were the big bricks that you had in the camera crew's cars. There was no Google. There was no YouTube. It was a completely different way of reporting. So what was it like reporting before the age of YouTube and Google? Was it easier or was it harder? Tony, let's start with you.
Well, I think the thing about it today is that in my early days, the worst problem you ever felt and came across was not being shot at, but was trying to get your story out. You could be up on the Vietnamese borders, and you'd have a wonderful story about shelling across the border or something like that. How do you get it out? You might have to wait 2 or 3 days on an airstrip in Quang Tri to get somebody to fly you down to Saigon. And that was the same everywhere. The business of using a telex, having the thing break down. And those things don't exist today. You can, as I've done, you can now sit in the middle of a battlefield, as I was in the first Gulf War, and you can talk to the office. What are you doing? We're just about to go out to lunch. What are you doing, Tony? I'm cowering, you know.
Yeah. And now you can send pictures via Twitter, and it's all so easy. Mm. Cameron, what's your feeling about how the technology has changed the way that we report foreign events?
Well, as someone who's never tweeted in his life and who's not on Facebook, I find this new media scene a foreign land. I really do, and it's a land that worries me.
Why?
Well, it worries me simply because what I did as a foreign correspondent, what my friends did, we covered news stories, we did analysis, we could pace ourselves, we could go in depth in the country. It just amazes me now, say, someone like the Age correspondent in Indonesia files online early and often, takes videos, then when he can fit it in, writes print stories. It seems to me that this spreads everything terribly thinly, and quite frankly, the idea of citizen journalism really concerns me too. I think it's an oxymoron. I think that you really should have seasoned foreign correspondents. You should have gatekeepers, but they're basically gone or going. And more's the pity, because
What do they add, though? What does the gatekeeper add?
Well, when I was foreign editor of The Age back in the 80s, in between foreign postings, I had, I think, 6 foreign correspondents. I had a few super stringers. I had access to the New York Times and to the Washington Post, LA Times News Service, to the Guardian News Service, and my assistant would start reading in early in the day, millions of words flowing in, and there was the gatekeeper, the foreign editor, could decide this was the story which was relevant. He could talk to the foreign correspondent, he could talk through the story with he or she. But these days, in fact, it's a tsunami of information. And the idea that this provides freedom for the consumer of information seems to me a total absurdity.
What's your take on this, Michael? Have we lost the art of analysis because we don't have thinking time anymore, or are citizen journalists adding value by providing us with stories that perhaps we wouldn't otherwise be able to find?
Well, at UPI, which is a news agency, or was a news agency, like Reuters or Associated Press, we used to have a motto, get it first, but first get it right. And I think what Cameron says that these days in fast-paced, when the poor reporter hasn't got time to do anything, he gets something, he's got no time to look at the background, he's got no time to check the context and put it out. You spoke about Twitters and tweets. Yes, they break, and whereas the wire services used to break the story, now it's whoever gets on Twitter first with he saw a murder, he saw a plane crash, he saw this, bang, but that's it, and then someone's got to pick it up and go through it, and someone's got to know how to check who, what the plane was, where it came from, who the murderer was, etc., etc. It doesn't come down. And if you're talking about citizen journalists, well, I can only quote one old correspondent who said, I trust citizen journalists as much as you trust citizen surgeons. So it's just not on.
Let me come back to you, Tony, because I don't think you got a chance to answer the idea of, along with this new technology comes the continuous deadline style of journalism. Do you think that you guys, when you reported, actually went through the golden age of being foreign correspondents?
Well, I think yes, except in my case, of course, I worked for Weekly, so I had the horror of getting a great story on Tuesday and waiting till Saturday till it came out. But generally, we had time to think, we had time to write, and, of course, photographers took pictures, we did the reporting, and you could compose stories, you could talk to the players, you could be on the scene, so you see something happen, then you go to the general or you go to the president or whoever it is, and then at the end of the day, over a beer, you compose your story. Now, you have continual questions coming in from the office, you know, Washington Post got this, AP's got this, AFP's got this, what do you say? And you say, well, hang on, we need it now, send anything. And of course,
sounds a bit like Scoop, actually.
Yeah, it manifests itself in a number of ways, like the fact that here we are with these amazing crises, if you like, Ebola, ISIS in the Middle East, absolute terror around the world, and the local TV news programs will usually begin with a car accident in Bentley or a report of a shark bite somewhere because they got film of a man with a bloody leg or a burning car. And the picture, the instant picture is much more interesting than some dreary explanation about why if we don't do something about Ebola now we'll all be dead in the gutter in 2 years' time.
You must admit, though, I mean, we do get a lot of coverage of foreign events because we are able now to get access to events that we wouldn't have had before. I mean, I can think of one that I've done, which is the Siege of Tripoli when the Arab Spring uprisings were happening. You couldn't get a reporter in there, but we could talk to them. And we could talk to them on Skype. You know, you do actually get access to foreign stories. Let me bring you into that broad range of history, though, because as we've heard from the bios of these three, I mean, they've pretty much covered every major conflict over the last more than half century. I wonder what that long view of history gives you. What perspective, so start with you again, Tony, what perspective do you have, for example, on the Hong Kong protests that are happening still now, having sat in Tiananmen Square in 1989 as the tanks rolled in? Does that give you a particular perspective on current events that have that similar flavour?
Well, it obviously gives you a perspective, but at the same time, if you ask me what's going to happen in Hong Kong, I don't know. But the thing is that in Tiananmen Square, the circumstances were similar. The kids were in the square for weeks. We used to go down and talk to them every day. The police did nothing. The army did nothing. And then, obviously, at some point, somebody said, listen, we're going to have to do something about this. So they sent in a weak regiment the first night, and the kids laughed at them. And they sent in a very tough regiment of country boys who really loathed these kids. And I remember being in the square and hearing gunfire, and I said to one of these young students, listen, I'm getting out of here, they're shooting people. And he said, Chinese soldiers would never shoot Chinese people. And the next minute a kid runs into the square waving this blood-soaked shirt. I suspect it won't happen. So I can see how the Chinese government can be violent if necessary. I think what's different in Hong Kong is that China has opened up more, it's become more sophisticated. It is also much more connected with the rest of the world. I don't think they could afford to have a massacre in Hong Kong, which is the third biggest commercial centre in Asia, as they did in Shanghai, which was then developing. And Shanghai and in Beijing, they were telling the Chinese people, listen, we're still in charge here. In Hong Kong, it's still pretty soft stuff, and I think there are signs even now that the kids are getting bored and the locals are getting really annoyed with the fact they can't go to work and things. So yeah. I see that dying away without bloodshed.
Well, you've all covered Asia. Michael, I can see you nodding your head there.
Yeah, I was in Hong Kong and I agree with him. What he said is, until it affects business and until they can't get money or do trades or whatever, they'll let the kids stay there. And in the end, it'll just drift away. They won't be sending in troops.
With your long perspective, though, does it give you? Do you think you look at events in a different way, Cameron?
Oh, I suppose the longest period. I was in Afghanistan first, in probably about 88.
Were there when the Soviets withdrew, weren't you?
That was later on. I went in first to meet the Mujahideen warlord. I went in from Peshawar, and while I was waiting to get the message I could cross the border, a man from Afghan Aid, lovely fellow, said, "What are you doing Sunday?" I said, "Nothing." He said, "There's a game of Bushkazi on. You should go there." So I did go across the border among the Mujahideen. And Bushkazi was the national sport of Afghanistan, which involved, so far as I could see, no rules, no structure, no nothing. It involved, there was a circle called the Circuit of Justice in line on the ground. There were about 30 or 40 horsemen clustered round it. There was a pole about a kilometre away. The idea was someone picked up the headless calf body and galloped away, and someone picked it up, and around him there was this sort of cohort of people who protected him for a while until they turned on him. He dropped the calf. And this went on all the time, rearing horses, flailing whips. They finished up in the crowd at one stage, but eventually, in the midst of the chaos, with no rules at all, there was a winner. And it seemed to me that Bushkazi was an irresistible metaphor for Afghanistan. Mm. Yeah, and yeah, the British were driven back in 1834, the famous picture of the one man, William Bryden, getting back to Jalalabad, in there for the Russian withdrawal. And then I went in, smuggled across the border to Kandahar to talk to the Taliban, and the Taliban were polite and totally firm. There was no negotiation. There would
and
be.
And what year would this have been?
This was 94. No, sorry, 95. They'd just been pushed back from Kabul, and the commander we gave a lift back down towards Quetta said, "Mr. Forbes, by the time you are back in Melbourne, we will have taken Kabul, and they had. And it seemed to me the thought of anyone going into Afghanistan with grand ideas of, first of all, conquering, but then secondly, creating democracy, totally absurd.
And the so fact after 9/11 you didn't support that?
No, I didn't. No,
because of your experience
But another thing...
If I could just say something, I was in Afghanistan when the Soviets came in, and that was January 1980, and you've never...
You guys have been around for a long time, haven't you?
No.
You've never seen anything like the Russian army on the move. I'd gone up to Herat, and they were coming down from Turkoman, and there was just tank after tank carried on tanks. The troops marching behind them were not your Caucasian. They were Uzbeks and the most unsavoury-looking characters, you know, straight out of Genghis Khan. And there were thousands of them, and truckloads, and artillery pieces. And I couldn't believe this. And Paul Banner said, the might of the Soviets, and, you know, they're here forever. Wrong.
But I can say now, I'll predict now, with all my perspective of being through all these wars in the Middle East, being with the Americans, I can tell you now that the Australians are going to die there and they're going to get into trouble. It's not going to work. And I know that.
Yeah.
But, you know, even if I write it, the government will say, oh, no, we will have no boots on the ground. And the papers have reported in the last couple of days, no boots on the ground. And I was listening to Julie Bishop last night, and what she said was, we don't envisage boots on the ground. There are going to be boots on the ground, and sometimes they won't be attached to the legs.
Well, let's look at Iraq, because you've also all had a long perspective on Iraq. How does the current conflict compare to, say, you know, the first, what we call the first Iraq War, the 1991 Iraq War?
Well, everything about Iraq and about the Middle East, one always forgets that it is... What Iraq are we talking about? Are we talking about Sunni-controlled Iraq? Are we talking about Shia-controlled Iraq? The Alawites, ISIS? You know, well, ISIS is Sunni, and, you know, they fight amongst themselves, always have and always will. And the fact that the West, in its stupidity, always seems to back the wrong side, is whatever happens. And
they end up fighting the ones they backed before, don't they?
Well, that's true, and that's what's happening now, and it will ever be thus.
Well,
to end the conflict in Northern Ireland, build a huge 1-mile-high wall around the whole country. Stand back, let them get on with it. Nobody in, nobody out, and then, after a year or two, look in, see who's won, and then nuke the lot of them, and you've won.
Oh, you're so cynical, you're so cynical.
Well, speaking of wars that seem to not change too much but keep going on in the Middle East, you've also all covered various aspects of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I mean, when you were covering it all those decades ago, did you think then that you would still be seeing the sort of, you know, the Gaza-Israeli conflict we've just seen recently?
I mean, yes.
You did?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, no question.
Yes.
Well, that's interesting. Any advice?
Let them get on with it.
They did build a wall, remember?
Well, I mean, one of the weird things that's happening now with the way ISIL is creating alliances we've never thought of before. ISIL are now on the borders of Israel in the sense that they're in Lebanon and that they're in Syria. And for once, Israel has an interest in share an interest with the non-Sunnis of the regions and the non-fanatics of the region. If there was anybody with any sense in the Israeli government, which is unlikely when it's headed by Netanyahu, they would actually be talking to the non-ISIL people and saying, look, you know, we have a mutual interest here in stopping these crazies.
Could I just... we were talking before about citizen journalism, correspondents and seasoned correspondents. Last week, Paul McGough of Fairfax wrote a terrific piece which goes to Tony's point, and which goes to the complexity of the Middle East. He's up the Bekaa Valley. He's talking to a Hezbollah village. Hezbollah is fighting ISIL. Hezbollah is regarded as a terrorist by the Yanks and by the Israelis. But now there's a common cause, actually, with Hezbollah, the terrorist, against the terrorists of ISIL.
It's not going to provide a solution in the long term, though?
No, it won't provide a solution. In my innocence, I used to think when I first went to the Middle East, a two-state solution, Israel back to the 67 borders, Jerusalem, a world city under UN control, not going to happen.
It all seems so simple until you actually go and report on it, doesn't it?
Everything seems simple until you get out there.
Well, actually, on that, given the perspectives that you have, how did you react when you heard the Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, call this, you know, the death cult, and this is a really important war, and this is a different war, and we have to be in this one for this reason, even though we've just withdrawn from Iraq? I mean, there is a certain logic looking at it purely in the present. I mean, you look at what's going on, and you think, well, we've got to do something. But how did you react how do you react when you hear politicians saying those sorts of things?
I think in the case of Australia, Tony Abbott salutes when the Americans say we need you to give some credibility to an international effort against these people. And of course, secondly, they're interested in preserving oil in that region for the West. And thirdly, they're interested in preserving Israel from the evil Muslims up the road. So those things are immutable in that part of the world. And Tony Abbott is just saluting, because the Australian effort, look, six planes and 200 guys, absolutely meaningless except in PR terms. And, of course, it really pisses off a lot of people with whom we've had good trades and relations in the Middle East in the past.
Yeah. What he says is right, of course, but the thing is, what I come back to, when you're dealing with ISIS, you're dealing with someone who doesn't like the awful Alawite government of Syria, and now suddenly, after being against the awful Alawite government of Syria, we're now pro the Alawite government of Syria, and it's these ISIL that are out of it. And again, it comes to money, the oil, and who's behind the oil and who gets the oil. But the Middle East itself is going to be in trouble, because America is becoming self-sufficient in oil and energy with their fracking, ruining the countryside, yes. But they're going to be self-sufficient in oil within the next 10 years.
What's that going to do to the geopolitics of the Middle East?
Well, you tell me. I think it's going to change quite a lot, and who controls it. What ISIL will do if they end up in control, and I think they probably will, then they're going to have to, well, we've got all this oil. Who wants to buy it? It's not going to happen in a while, but in the long-term view, and coming back to the knee-jerk reaction to Abbott, even you've got to look at what the Americans have done. They haven't done a lot in things. They've put no troops on the ground there. They're bombing with the French, but they're never going to win with bombing.
Well, they're trying to encourage the other Arab nations to get involved.
Yes, but who are the other Arab nations? The Shias of Iran, the Alawites of Syria?
They're not trying to encourage Iran, but they are trying to encourage Saudi Arabia.
Well, and who do you think's providing the money for ISIS?
Exactly.
this is what's never been reported. Or, you know, if it does, it's all innuendo. But if you had a good correspondent there who could say, well,
I've got to tell you, it is being reported, but but to come to you, Cameron, what was your reaction when you heard the sort of death cult language that was being used by the Prime Minister?
Oh, basically, here we go again. The problem of Australian foreign policy is the Grand Alliance, which the Korean War was the start of it all. We joined the coalition of the willing there, though it had nothing to do with us at all. But part of the reason was Percy Spender in particular wanted the ANZUS Treaty. And Percy, in fact, rushed troops on the ground. The 3rd Battalion, which wasn't ready to fight, which the generals had told him a stupid move. But in fact, Menzies didn't really care much about Anzac. Spencer wanted it, and eventually, after our people started dying, after the Mustangs of the RAF went in, he got the Anzac Treaty. The Turks were in there at the same time, and I couldn't work out for a start why the Turks were there. In fact, there was going to be a joint Anzac Day celebration with the Turks and at a place called Capion. Unfortunately, 10,000 Chinese troops intervened. But when I talked to Turks about this, I said, why were you there? And they said, well, look, we didn't even know where Korea was, but we were there because our government wanted membership of NATO. And the Turkish press at that stage, when they got membership of NATO, wrote, the signature has been signed in the gallant blood of our soldiers. Well, in fact, the same thing happened with Anzus. The signature was signed in the blood of the 340-odd Aussies who died there. And since then, it's been this atrocious obscenity of not thinking for yourself and of bowing to the American alliance.
It sounds almost from all of you as though your experience as foreign correspondents has made you want Australia to be isolationist in a sense and just to pull back from conflicts in the world. Would that be a fair assessment?
Isolationist is much too strong a word.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, we are at the bottom of the Pacific. You don't have... it's an old axiom that in diplomacy you don't have friends, you have alliances. The Americans won't... If we're suddenly overrun by the Chinese and the Americans have no interest, they're not going to turn up here. So we should be cultivating the Chinese, the Japanese, the Indonesians, and of course we should stay friendly with America, but we shouldn't have, for instance, 60 M1A1 tanks outside of Darwin in a country which only has, as far as I remember, three bridges which would support a 60-ton tank. So unless they're going to be chasing the Pitjantjatjara over the great Western Desert, they're there so Australians can get in those tanks if they are required by the Americans in the Middle East. So we're much too close.
Michael, you don't think we should be isolationists? You think that's too strong?
Yes, yeah, no, it is. And let's face it, the American alliance does go back quite a way, as they did. They did help us out in World War II, after all. So I think it's an alliance that you have to look at. But because the world is changing now and China is suddenly... You know, we're admitted in before when we had communist China and it wasn't allowed in the United Nations, then we all knew who the enemy was. Now China's friendly, so we should be quite friendly with China. We should be friendly with the Japanese, our former enemies, which makes an alliance with America a little suspect. But no, I don't think we can afford to be isolationist. We have to have alliances or friendships with the countries immediately to us, as we say, like Japan, Indonesia, and elsewhere. The Middle East? No, that's not in our sphere of interest, I don't think. So,
let me bring this to a more personal level now. You've all been in really difficult situations. What is the personal toll of being a foreign correspondent? For example, when did you first feel that your life was in danger? First to you, Tony.
Oh, in a minor way, was in Northern Ireland just after the Troubles began, and I was out with a British soldier and a sniper up at the end of this dark little street started chipping away at us, and we just lay in the gutter with the water pouring all over us, and the soldier said to me, he's firing through the letterbox at the top of the street there, he said, with this heavy rifle, I could kill him. The bullet goes straight through the door, and it goes straight through him, and then it goes straight through Mrs. O'Malley in the house next door and probably kill her dog as well. So that was the first time, and the worst time was in Beirut when people broke into my house and tied me up. And one of the guys stuck a pistol in my ear and said, you die now, and he clicked the Hammerback. And I wrote about this in a book, and I said, I felt exactly the same way in that instant as you do when you dive off a bridge or a high tower. And in that moment before you hit the water, everything ceases. You know, you have no feelings until you hit the water. Having said that, I've never had a nightmare. I've never been frightened in the next instance. And
you didn't reconsider, you know, you didn't think I'll change my job?
Oh, absolutely not. No, no. I mean, and the reason why I say that is that I've been in a lot of dangerous situations, but when I choose to go to a war knowing it's going to be dangerous, then it's my decision and I'm totally fatalistic. When I'm on a tram late at night and there are three drunk kids there with a bottle saying, "What are you looking at?" That's when I get scared.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I have been asking the three of you about post-traumatic stress, and one of my colleagues and friends, Sally Sara, who is one of our best reporters and is an extremely brave woman, has just come out and talked about her experience of post-traumatic stress. And I'm getting a real sense of resistance to admitting to any sort of sense of trauma from your reporting, but you've been in such dangerous places. You're really telling me that you don't feel any sense of trauma from it?
No. It's but again, we were different. You know, we could walk around, which we did in Beirut, and we had Sahafi, press, Prensa, in "Don't shoot" in six languages, and you walked around with that and you felt fine.
And has that changed?
Well, yes, it has, because the terrorists...
The ISIL
today, A, can't read, and B, they want to shoot you, so they do, and then chop your head off. But also in those... Like, I was in Cyprus when the Turks invaded, and you could drive from one side to the other across with a white flag, which again said "press, don't shoot, white," and you went and you drove through. Once I drove up a tree and there was a minefield, and I'm driving through the minefield. Oh God! And there's a photographer behind me saying, "They're mines, you know." And I said, "Yes, I know." And we drove, and the Turks had put a tree down, and I had to stop at the tree, and a head popped up over the tree and said, "You've just driven through the minefield." And I said, "Yes, I want to see your colonel." He goes, "It's very dangerous." And no, you didn't care. And
well,
today...
You sense of immunity. Being,
yeah,
being
but the thing was, you know, I'm talking 30 years ago, 20 years ago, where correspondents of my age and even older, some of them, like when I was a kid in the Congo, my heroes were people who were... One had been a Spitfire pilot, another was on the Burma Railroad. These were journalists who'd been to war, and then, unfortunately, they died. But a lot of the Americans had been combat soldiers. I myself had done some army training in 1953 with the 1st National Service Mob. So you had an idea of what a gunshot, and you had an idea of what military procedure was. Today, all a bit different. You know, we've got terrorists, we've got guerrillas, we've got people. So for me, no, I don't think post-traumatic stress would ever feel, would ever affect me. For a youngster who's never been shot at or never been, suddenly he's there and boom, 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 the guns are going off, then it might affect him.
And especially now if journalists are targets, which they are increasingly in some of these wars.
Yeah.
And Cameron, personal toll, relationships, it hasn't affected, you know, this sort of seeing, even if it's not your own life at risk, seeing horrific things happen to other people, that hasn't affected you personally?
I thought when this suggestion came that we would be discussing this, I said no, basically, that no counselling, maybe a good stiff scotch and what was called fining the proprietors when you got out of So We're Nasty, looking for the most expensive bottle of wine on the hotel wine list. But then, you know, first shot at in the Philippines, People's Power Revolution, supposed to be nice and friendly, wasn't.
Really? When was that?
Not for everyone. That was 1986. Then Rwanda, I suppose, was my worst time. And I was the first outsider to the Ntarama Church massacre. And we'd driven along with our minder, who had a hand grenade. He was an ex-physics professor, and he kept flicking the pin of the hand grenade, so I took that off him. But we drove towards...
He's meant to be looking after you.
That's right. We drove towards the church, and then we were following a footpath. There was a woman's body there. We drove through a grove of trees where the sunlight was coming down and butterflies were playing. And then we got to this, what I then called with great accuracy, the devil's playground. Ernest had said to me, be careful when you get out because there'll probably be unexploded grenades round. But when I got out, the first thing I had to step up out over was a baby's body cut in half. And the church was just a carnel house.
Did you have children at that point?
I had children, and this is the other thing about technology. At that stage, no mobile phones. We carried small tents. We sort of slept with Rwandan RPA patrols. You had to come across the border to Kabuli to file your story, and you had to come across a mountain track, which was, I was going to say, infested, but there were lots of inter-harmway around the place still. The main road you couldn't use. When I got to Kabuli, I found a fax which said Cameron Forbes's wife has given birth to a daughter, and I thought immediately of miracles like the virgin birth and things like that, and then I realised that they met my granddaughter. But when I came back, Anne picked me up from the airport, as she usually did, and drove me home, but then suddenly turned left to my son's place, and Belinda, his wife, was there waiting there, opened the door and put Ruby, aged a couple of weeks, in my arms. And I must admit, it was a time of terrible, not terrible, wonderful catharsis. So I suppose, those things probably affect you more than you think. And I know Tony himself wrote a quite wonderful book called God Cried, which dealt with the things he saw in Lebanon. And I'm not sure now about how really hardened inside my two great friends are, as when I think, no, okay, right, he's very hard inside.
very
hard inside.
You know, I've evolved a theory that the reason why policemen get counselling and everybody gets counselling, including young reporters, is that everybody sees so much death on television that they think death is easy. Somebody gets a bullet there and there's a little bit of red and they fall down and they're there and that's it. It's not messy, it's not smelly. And then they see a split open corpse with the eyes bulging out of its skull, or they come across a pile of bloated, rotting bodies, and suddenly the reality of real death hits them for the first time and they can't have it. They can't take it.
And why didn't it hit you guys then?
Because we saw the real... A lot of the real... Well, I mean, I grew up in the country, so right from the beginning I was... I was seeing animals slaughtered, you know, and I was killing rabbits, and so I had blood on my hands from the age of three, if you like, so...
You're a tough man.
But I think
I'm a sweetie, really.
Deep down he's shallow. Yeah.
Sorry, Cameron.
Tony said earlier, I mean, I actually, when the chance came to go to these various places, yeah, I put my hand up, you know. It was part of the job. And, I mean, my concern with all these places really was, and I suppose I've been more a fly-in, fly-out journalist than maybe my two friends have been, but my concern was, you know, the soldiers I left behind. And the thought that every day they got up and they took the first step into that terrible land where it was kill or be killed, and they did that day after day after day after day. I mean, I've got no problems with veterans coming back and wanting and needing counselling. That should happen. You know, we three were basically volunteers, and there was a lot of... Between the nastiness, there was a lot of upside, there was a lot of excitement, there was a lot of wonder and colour and movement to being a foreign correspondent.
It's incredibly exciting. I mean, in the first Gulf War, we came across the desert towards the Iraqi lines, a row of 40 tanks like this, all of them firing 50 calibre tracer into a mist. And we're watching the Iraqi tanks blow up in the air, and suddenly the whole horizon was lit by a series of explosions among the oil tanks. And two guys on motorbikes started off here, and I thought, up until then, every time I saw people get away in the movies, I thought, oh, come on, you know. Here's 50 tanks with coaxial machine guns, and these guys drive across the whole horizon, and neither of them were hit. So it's a drama, it's like the movies sometimes.
Now, I think it might be time to come to questions from the floor, if there are any.
Put on his glasses.
I'd be very interested in your views about a Prime Minister's language to a rather more important person who lives in Russia.
Well... Ask yourself, what would you do if you were Russian and someone said in Russian, I'm going to shirt front you? You'd reach for your dictionary. So, obviously,
I think
you did
that in Australia, didn't we?
No, well, we're from Melbourne, we understand these things. But probably up there in Queensland they reached.
In Sydney.
He probably thought what I thought, which is, what an oaf, what an oaf.
once he knew what it meant, yes. And then he said, and I'll have him.
Cameron, did you have a view on that?
Oh, it was just stupid, outrageous, but then you're accustomed to that from someone who was probably rightly called the Mad Monk.
Or, as he said, himself, a suppository of all wisdom.
Yeah. And a question over here.
Thank you, gentlemen. I'm really enjoying this, but those sorts of comments, though, aren't they a new form of let's get off the real topic and let's not talk about the things that are really important? Isn't that what the politicians are actually doing with these silly statements and these silly comments? Would you say that's part of the current political landscape?
I think it was just Tony Abbott, frankly. I don't think it was a diversion from politics. I think it demonstrates... I mean, part of my problem is that I think probably he is an intelligent man. I don't know. Okay, Oxford doesn't mean much. Rhodes Scholarship.
He played rugby, mate.
Well, so did I, but still. And Cole Adams played too. I just think it's symptomatic of the man. Well, I agree. The charade and circus of Australian politics, I mean, that's, I was going to say, as bad as Rwanda, but it's not. I mean, it's just an absurdity. It's a betrayal of what should be happening in this country.
Do you want to have a crack at that one?
No, I think it's just a... He's a politician, after all, and politicians, their feet are in their mouths, so away they go. I agree with you at a point that politicians do, when they're asked something, will say, that's a very good question, and then say something completely different, but let's talk about this or that. And so, yes, it is a deflection as such, but in this particular case, I think it was just Tony Abbott saying, I'm the tough man and I'm running G20, and when he comes here, he's going to get an earful. Well, we'll see. But,
I have to say that over all these years, my contempt for politicians and my belief they reflexively lie has grown stronger and stronger. I've been lied to by so many politicians in so many countries that I tend now, when I hear a politician speak, I think, now what's he really saying? So I find I trust peasants and soldiers more, and I basically don't trust politicians at all, anywhere, not just here, anywhere.
Now there's a question down here.
Just wondered what you thought about the Australian government's response when the reporters were cold-bloodedly shot dead in East Timor.
Do you mean back in the 70s?
Yes.
Yeah. Did you know the reporters personally, any of you?
I didn't know the Bellabo Five, but I did know Roger East. And Roger East, in fact, was a smart and sensible and brave man who was killed on the wharf in Dili. My feeling was that the Australian government attitude was terrible. The acquiescence to Indonesia was terrible. This was partly Gough Whitlam, who had ideas of nice, tidy things in the world, nice, tidy blocks, and hence they gave a de jure recognition to the Soviet occupation of the Baltic states, which was a crime. And I think their attitude to East Timor and to Indonesia was a crime also.
No, I don't know anything about it. I was not there.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I was in Africa at the time.
I guess there's a similar case at the moment with the Gresta case. I mean, he's not killed, but he's been imprisoned for a long, long time. Do you think the government's handled that well?
We don't know what they're saying. It was obviously, I mean, the trial was a farce, but El-Sisi has said that he couldn't interfere with a judicial process, and there have been suggestions that Abbott saw him recently and that some deal is going to be done, so we can only hope. But so I wouldn't blame him yet.
Yeah.
And there's a question down the back there.
Hello, Michael, Tony and Cameron, thank you all. How much of what we are able to learn by way of newspapers and such like, both officially and in repertorial terms, about world events is designed to make us respond in particular ways to those events or to the causes around them? I suppose I mean that we hear very little about events taking place in South America or Central America unless something really awful happens, or in Central Asia unless something really awful happens, and yet we're continually faced with the awful stuff that is happening at the moment in the Middle East, probably as a way of encouraging us to feel that we should do something about it. How much of the way that news is arranged, at least partly by way of the official management behind it, is supposed to cause us to look in those directions?
Well, it's very much the hometown. News is a hometown event. And when I say hometown, I mean Melbourne newspapers are different to Brisbane newspapers, which are different to what you read in Darwin. And the same is throughout the world. America, for instance, I worked for an American news agency. Whenever we had a thing, we had to say so-and-so of Dallas, Texas was injured in the bus crash in India. You had to have the hometown in there. The usual thing was one American killed and 500,000 Indians killed in a cyclone. You know, that was the headline. But coming to what's happening in South America, South America is not in Australia's sphere of interest. If you're in Texas, yes, what was happening in South America and where it's much closer, then you'd start to read about it. So I think it depends where you are, and this even exists in Europe. You go where I've just come back from Europe. You read in the British papers, of which there's more than any country I know of, you don't see what's happening in Australia apart from the cricket. And so it's where you are. And coming back to what we were talking before, the value of the internet, if you want to know what's going on in South America, there's umpteen sites and websites can tell you. They're true or not's another matter.
But that the one thing to be said about these enormous number of sources now available is that Rupert Murdoch can't control the world because Edward Snowden and Julian Assange and thousands of bloggers do end runs around the conventional media. So a lot to be said. I mean, much as I find it a lot of irritation from sloppy reporting and people thinking that anything with a track on it is a tank, the great thing is that you don't have to rely on the state radio and the privately owned mass press anymore.
So their message can be diluted.
Outright contradicted, of course.
Cameron, you're a former news editor. The idea of what is news, I think, is the fundamental question here.
Yes, it is, and the problem, you know, has been, well, a sort of isolationism down here, tucked on the end of Asia. Africa literally has been a black hole, and it's the same point that Tony and Mike are making. That there is no direct interest. Rwanda, what got me angry about Rwanda was the world sat on its hands. The first person I met was Brigadier Dallier, the Canadian. We drove, there were fighting that was going on around the airport, and I went to the UN headquarters basically because I wanted a flak jacket. But there was a party going on, and beer was being drunk, and it turned out the major from Senegal had been promoted. So I went upstairs to Dallier in his office. I said, what's going on? He said, well, they're having a party. And I said, well, what are you doing? And he pointed out the door, the window, and he had, I think, 13 APCs there. He said, I've got 137 men, I've got 13 APCs, they're killing hundreds of thousands, no one's doing anything, and then he cried. Mm. And when I was in Washington, I saw a small piece in the Washington Post saying that former commander found under park bench, and it was a small thing saying, Brigadier Dallier was found in a fetal position, drunk under a park bench in Toronto. Oh. And I knew what had happened there. But the point is, politicians will attempt to set the agenda, and you've got to allow for that. But the other point is that with finite space, it does come down to what can be a very difficult decision on where stories run. I mean, the old question of, you know, one white death worth 100 black deaths. You know, it's not good. And I suppose I have to join in the thought that that at least you can access various sources now, should you wish. But then you take your chance on how good those sources are to give you a picture of South America or Africa.
I think we've got time for one more. There's one down the back there. I'll see if we can get to you as well.
I'm quite interested in this matter that you touched on earlier of getting the story out. You talked about how the technology's changed, but I was wondering if you might sort of take us back and go through some of the mechanics, if you like, of actually getting a story out. So, my question is in part prompted by general curiosity, but this morning I saw that Peter Greste had in fact delivered a speech in absentia last night, and that although he's now been in prison in Egypt for I think, more than 300 days, and he's not allowed to write more than a letter a month or something. He was able to dictate this speech to his visitors, who then put it together and delivered it on his behalf. So that was an incredible example of getting the story out. But the kinds of mechanisms that were previously involved, now it's just a matter of opening your laptop, sending off an email. What were the kind of processes before this technology that was required? Did you, how did you actually get the story out from where you were?
Well, let me jump in there, because I work for a news agency, UPI, as I mentioned, but the first news agency, Reuters, their first dispatch that they got out was by carrier pigeon, which was the stock market report in Brussels to Paris, and that was the very first foreign news carried by Reuters. And when I joined UPI, or United Press as it then was, in 1956 in London, radio telex was the only way you got news. And it was fearfully expensive. That was the big killer for news agencies and also for newspapers. Telex was £1 a minute. Radio things, we had a set fee, but you had to punch tape. You've probably seen it, like the original ticker tape parade. You punch the tape, fed it through a radio transmitter, out it would go, and it would be picked up in New York and then sent by landline, also at fearful expense, through the cost of AT&T to the various states. And if it came to Australia, the same thing.
I want to tell my story line. Now.
Now you'll tell. I'm the technical. He's got the jokes.
At the end of the Biafran War, the whole front had collapsed, and my photographer and I managed to get back to Lagos, and we found that all the communications were down because the Nigerians didn't want anyone to know about the terrible things that had happened to Biafra. And I was with a very crafty old photographer, and he said, write your story out, mate. And I wrote my story out, and he said, let's go out to the airport. And I said, they're not going to take anything at the airport. Come on. And he said, just come out to the airport. So we're standing at the airport, and a 12, 13-year-old white girl in a school uniform with a straw hat and a school bag came up, and my mate went up and said, you want to make 20 quid? And she said, he said, look, just take this little package, take it round to the Sunday Times, and they'll give you 20 quid. And it was his film and my story. She put it in a school bag, waved through, and the next day we were arrested when the story appeared.
But it got out.
It got out.
Cameron, do you want to have a quick word on that one?
Oh, well, I travelled with Rajiv Gandhi on by accident, in a way, on the day of the first assassination attempt. We were flying down to Mahatma Gandhi's ashram in Nagpur, and we had this face-to-face in his cabin in the 737. I got there, went to the ashram. I had this story. No one else was on the plane. So I said to him, he said, will you come to the rally? I said, no, I've got to file the story. I went to the hotel. All the telephone lines were down. There was a telex behind a grill. I said to the proprietor, can I use the telex? He said, yes, you certainly can. I said, but it's locked. He said, yes, because the man's got the key and he's in his home village. So then I thought airport. So I used my credentials to get to the conning tower of the airport, and there was a phone there. I explained I'd been with their prime minister. They thought this was wonderful that I could tell his story. I said, there's a telephone there. Can I use it? And they said, you certainly can. They said, but it is broken. So then I said, do you know where I can get a beer? There were no flights out, of course, and later the story still ran on front page the next day. But you would kill for a sat phone.
Oh. Yeah.
Very different.
Now, with your indulgence, there was a lady at the front here that had a question. We really have to wrap up after this one, if we can make this one quick.
Sorry, just a quick, simple question, really. As a journalism student, being told that there's no jobs and to change my major, I was just wondering, do you have any advice or key advice you wanted to give a new generation of journalists when, you know, it's shrinking and they're relying on citizen journalism?
Well, yes, change your job, like they said, yes, once. Because, no, I sympathise with anyone wanting to be a, quote, foreign correspondent today, to go to foreign places and correspond, because it doesn't happen anymore. And, Cameron mentioned before about Paul McGough writing a story, but how many people have read that story? Not a lot. If they read it on the internet, fine. No, my advice, I'm very worried about you.
Anyone got anything positive to say here?
Yeah, be brave and follow your star. Go for it.
I'll second that.
And I always used to tell young players this, but I would probably hesitate now. I always used to say, go to the most dangerous place, because there'll be nobody else reporting there and you'll always be able to sell stories. Now, and I did that with people in Vietnam, people when I was in India, I'd say, you know, go up to the Pakistani border. I would hesitate to tell any young person to go to Iraq or Lebanon at the present time. This is the first time where I think that it's just too dangerous for anyone.
You have got a soft heart after all. Look, thank you so much, everyone, for coming. And my point is, yes, please do be a journalist. It's a fabulous job.